Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Jason Ware, Chief Investment Officer for Albion Financial Group, joins us this morning to walk through what's happening in the stock market as it set a historic closing record in March. Jason, thanks for joining us on Mountain Money.
Good to be here. Good morning.
Let's begin with a general look at the stock market. The S&P 500 set a record high close on March 28, 2024, and yet last week it was on course for its worst weekly performance since October. In your eyes, what are the key factors leading to these two statistics?
So we have momentum in the market. Last year in 2023, the stock market did quite well, and that momentum has continued into 2024. Now, why is it continued into 2024? The hopes for the quote-unquote soft landing, where we get inflation down but unemployment stays low, I think is growing in number. The number of people, the number of investors that think that the Fed can achieve a soft landing, I think, has improved. And then, of course, the expectation for the Federal Reserve to begin lowering interest rates has permeated Wall Street as well. So those two factors have led to an increased push higher for the stock market. Regarding the most recent pullback, I think we have to put that in context. It's been really small. It's about 2% from the closing high on the 28th that you referenced to, I think April 4th, where before the jobs report. And that 2% is a small volatility. And to put that into context, if you go back over the last 44 years, we're seeing the lowest amount of downside volatility in the U.S. stock market since 1980. The best year for lack of downside volatility was 1995, where we only had a couple of pullbacks of 3%. So it's been a pretty quiet year as far as the market sliding.
You mentioned in passing, I think, the jobs report. One of the things I really like is that a jobs report will come out and you have no idea how the market's going to react to it. Is it good news? Is it bad news? Obviously, it indicates some kind of strength in the economy if we have, higher than expected job growth. Why does the market act so schizophrenic when it comes to job reports?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the simple answer is that there's so much to unpack in the jobs reports, right? And some of it might imply that the economy is strong, sometimes too strong, and some of it might imply that the economy is weak or weakening. So for example, we get the headline number, that is the total number of jobs created. In the most recent report is 303,000. But, we also look at things like the unemployment rate, and the unemployment rate can tell us, can give us insight into how the labor market's doing. Wages are important, and wages are important just in general, because obviously wages or income, that's the fountain from which consumers spend, right? That's the income that they use to consume, and the consumer is the biggest part of the economy. So wages are important. But more recently, in the last couple of years, wages have been important because the Fed is looking at wages as an indicator of inflation. And of course, inflation has been running high for a couple of years, and the Fed has been working very diligently to get that down. So we look at jobs numbers, we look at unemployment, we look at wages, we look at participation. There's so much to unpack there. And then we also get revisions. So it's a big report. The jobs market is arguably the most important sub-market within the economy, because obviously a fully employed economy is a strong economy. So that's what we look for when we get jobs reports.
And you just went through a good number of factors that the market is based upon. But I want to go back a little bit to the Federal Reserve's discussion regarding interest rates. And you had mentioned that many people believe a soft landing is achievable. So knowing that that's kind of strengthening the stock market, I'm interested to know what will happen, that first day when interest rates drop. Will we see a significant increase on the stock market?
Hard to know, right? Because we're talking about prediction, and I think Buffett likes to say that forecasting tells you more about the forecaster than it does the future. So I don't know what's going to happen the day that we get the first interest rate cut, but I would speculate that it's probably not going to be as powerful or meaningful as maybe we're all kind of building it up to be. And the reason I say that is because the market is already anticipating that the Fed is going to cut rates. That in part, as I mentioned, when we started the discussion, that is being built into the stock market at these levels. I think the more interesting question is what happens if we don't get the interest rate cut this year? What happens if the Fed doesn't begin to ease this year? Are markets too high, are markets too elevated relative to that outcome? And I would argue they probably are if you're looking at it on over a short-term basis. But again, I think the market is firmly pricing in the fact that the Fed is going to cut. So I would expect probably not too much in the way of fireworks.
The traditional, at least recent target for the Fed is, I believe, 2% inflation, that they're trying to manage the economy to get to a 2% number. Is there some dialogue now about whether that is the right number, whether that's a realistic number, given, and I suppose given the current rates are running right around that, you'd have to, it's a robust question in terms of the extent to which it drives Fed behavior.
Yeah, so you're getting into a very touchy area within, you know, Fed circles, which is, should we change our target of 2% inflation? And right now, I think the short answer is that they're not going to make any changes on that, because I think there's with that comes a whole host of like credibility issues. If they say, well, we're trying to get to 2%, we may not get there, so let's just call it 3% and say that's good enough. The Fed wants to be very deliberate in how they try to manage inflation expectations. And one part of inflation expectations is being consistent in terms of how the Fed views the most appropriate level of inflation. So I don't think we're going to see a change from the Fed in terms of like their target. I think they believe they can get inflation down to 2%. We're just going to have to be very patient in terms of getting there. As you mentioned, you know, we're kind of, if you average out the statistics, we're getting close. You know, in June of 22, the headline CPI, which by the way, we'll get a CPI print. That's one of the most important inflation gauges that everyone looks at. We'll get a CPI print this week, so all eyes will be on that. But, you know, almost two years ago, we were running over 9%, right. And today we're firmly in around 3 to 3.5%. The Fed's preferred measure of PCE is lower. It's in the twos. So we're getting there. We're just going to have to be patient on the path to 2%.
And as you said, there's no guarantee that the Feds will cut the interest rate this year. What is guaranteed is that there's an upcoming presidential election and something will happen there. With regards to the election, you know, and markets, you know, does the election impact stocks, or is it the other way around? Do stocks impact the election?
Yeah, that's a very important question, because, of course, we are in an election year, as you noted. And there are all sorts of stats showing this or that regarding elections and markets. But history shows us that election years have little impact on the stock market. It's typically the third best year of the four-year election cycle when you look at it, historically speaking. Annual gains are usually just below the long-run average. Now, that isn't to say that elections don't produce volatility in the stock market. And I think that's the better way to think about it. Not, well, the market be up or down because of the election. Really, the market's going to be up or down this year because of corporate earnings, because of interest rates, because of inflation, and because of what the Fed does, the economy. Those are the things that are, that's the cocktail that's most important to stock prices. Elections don't matter too much, but we will see some volatility. Typically, what you see is you have the first part of the year, stocks rise. As we get into the middle part of the year, they start to consolidate or fall because we get closer to the election, and then after the election we get a relief rally. And I suspect maybe something similar to that could unfold this year. Though the other part of your question, is it the other way around, is an interesting one, because we also know that stocks can have an impact on how we vote, right? Mm-hmm. If the market is higher, if the economy is doing well, then that's often positive for the incumbent.
As things develop though this summer, is it possible that there are perceived policy differences between the presumptive, what will then be the nominees, I assume, Trump and Biden, the perceived policy difference such that as the probabilities of one or the other achieving victory begin to solidify, could that end up having the market go, I see a Trump victory coming, therefore X, or I see a Biden victory coming, therefore Y?
Yes, it can. And I think that's encapsulated in that volatility mid-year that we often see as the nominees become clear, which, like you said, they are clear at this point. We start to pick apart, well, what are their policy differences, and is the incumbent going to continue with what they've done, and how has that impacted the economy? And if we come in and shake things up, how is that going to change the course of corporate profits and regulation and tax cuts? And all of those things get into the soup of decisions that investors make, and that creates the volatility.
Yeah. And particularly, we hear the stories from this weekend's fundraiser where Trump has said that he will maintain or even enhance tax cuts, which I know are coming up. There's some expirations coming up if nothing happens. So I would think that would be a factor that might affect the market.
Yeah, 100%.
There are a number of geopolitical issues facing the market. How has the war in Ukraine and Gaza, along with the disruptions in the Red Sea, impacted the market?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I mean, the short answer is not much. The S&P is up about 20% since October 7th. Oil prices are largely unchanged, and actually have been lower for the most part over the past 6 months. So as far as the market's impact, it's been very little. And if you're, you know, if you're investing in stocks, you wouldn't even notice that there's, you know, trouble in the Middle East, right? But there are economic impacts, which we have seen. We've certainly seen shipping delays as ships are rerouted away from the Red Sea and down around the bottom of Africa. We've seen shipping costs go up by quite considerably higher in terms of those seaborne routes. So definitely some economic impacts. And I think as we try to read the tea leaves on, is that going to show up in broader inflation statistics? That's an important thing to keep in mind. So far, we haven't seen much of that. But if this continues to go on, or it were indeed to, you know, ramp up to a new level, which causes bigger dislocations, then we might be having a different conversation in a few months.
I wondered, you know, a couple of weeks ago, whether the taking out of the Key Bridge in Baltimore would have a substantial effect on supply chains and associated costs. And as a logical matter, you would think it would because of the amount of volume that goes to the Port of Baltimore. But so far, we haven't really seen that much of a market impact of that, have we?
Yeah, we haven't. And, you know, we have to remember, we had the ultimate test of global supply chains, you know, just a couple of years ago with the pandemic. And I think, you know, the good news is the silver lining from those types of, you know, difficult events, whether it's a financial crisis in 2008 or whether it's a pandemic in 2020, is that the capitalist system, global commerce, learns and adjusts and gets better. And I think that's perhaps, again, one of the things that we can take with the pandemic is that people have been reorienting supply chains. They've been changing how they buy. They've been changing how they manage inventories, all to the betterment of our ability to get goods, our ability to price goods, and our ability to kind of manage these events, if you will.
Rent the Runway recently announced a 1-for-20 reverse stock split to keep it on the Nasdaq, to keep its Nasdaq listing. Can you highlight this unusual move?
Yeah, they're essentially just trying to keep their price up to stay listed. So, you know, whether it's the Nasdaq or whether it's the NYSE, they have listing requirements. And one of those listing requirements is that the price of the stock is at a certain level. And usually those requirements are very, very low. It's like $5 or $1. So when you do a reverse stock split, you're essentially just trying to manage the price of your stock above that listing requirement. So it is unusual, although it's not unprecedented. We've certainly seen this before.
And this feels like a fundamentally practical move, right? In other words, you want to stay listed, you got to do something. This is something you can unilaterally do. Right. On the other hand, I want to talk about a couple of what I thought were more interesting moves, which is the decisions by Walmart and Chipotle to announce large, you know, massive stock splits. You know, I think one of them was like 50-1, which they say is to facilitate the ability for employees to buy stock. Is this a new phenomenon? And is that really why you think they're doing it?
Yeah, I do think that's why they're doing it. I think in particular with regards to Chipotle, I think that's why they're doing it. And it is somewhat of a newer phenomenon to use, you know, your stock to incentivize and better align the economics of your workforce and, like, you know, business success and profits. So I celebrate it. I think it's a good move. I think it's how companies should manage that relationship between, you know, their partners on the front line that are really, like, making the business tick every day in and day out. And obviously the rewards that are more often than not end up accumulating to the executives that own stock, right? So I think this is a great way to democratize that. So I think it's a good thing.
Let's take it down a level just as a practical matter. Why does it matter? In other words, why does this facilitate employee stock ownership?
Well, because essentially what Chipotle is doing is they're saying we're gonna issue more shares, and we're gonna have those shares go out to the store managers that are running our Chipotle. So when they feel like they have skin in the game and they feel like they have ownership in a company, that can change, obviously, I think, how they run their stores. And usually that's good.
And I was just asking a basic mechanical question. I understand it. If the stock price is cheaper and I've got it in a stock employee stock purchase plan, I may not be able to afford $500 if I'm aligned employees for a share of stock, but I might well be able to afford 50. And I guess it also is true that it allows them to, as you just said, deploy stock options or stock benefits at a level that's consistent with the kind of economics that makes sense for the lower employee level.
So it widens the pie.
Exactly.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
I know that in past discussions, EVs have always come up as a great place to be able to look at investment. What is the future of EVs, especially now that the first quarter auto sales numbers are available?
Yeah. So, you know, we think the future of EVs is bright. You know, our view is that EVs will likely grow 20 to 25% this year. And while that growth rate is admittedly slowing down, we've seen it slow down year over year over the past few years. You know, we have to understand that within that, you know, there's a greater context. So, for example, this year in 2024, global EV sales will likely exceed 16, maybe 17 million cars. That number just got above 1 million in 2017. So we've seen a 16 to 17 fold increase in 7 years. So the growth rate for electric vehicles, the adoption curve for electric vehicles has been extremely steep for the better part of the last half decade. So we should expect that that's going to moderate at some point. You have early adopters, you have, you know, range is being extended because battery technology is getting better. You have better infrastructure. So that was really that first, or we have improving infrastructure, I should say. That's part of that first adoption curve. And I think the second wave of folks buying electric vehicles is going to be slower than that first wave. But we still think that growth is happening, and we're still quite optimistic that by 2030, by 2040, we're going to see a significant number of new cars sold globally and here in the United States being electric vehicles.
And how have the domestic auto manufacturers positioned themselves? Does their current stock price reflect the fact that they've gotten themselves into a reasonable position? And isn't it different between the various manufacturers?
Yeah, they haven't positioned themselves well, unfortunately. You know, the market for electric vehicles here in the United States has been a story of insurgent automakers coming in, like Tesla and Rivian, doing electric vehicles well, while the more established OEMs in Detroit have really struggled and foundered with EVs. And then there's a number of reasons for that. We could do a whole show on electric vehicles versus ICE vehicles, and, you know, why it's difficult to suddenly kind of pivot from doing 80 years of making combustion engines and going into electric vehicles. It's very much a different business. It's more of a technology business than it is a traditional auto business. They're doing some things right. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think the fit and finish for some of those and more established automakers look better than, say, Tesla often. Tesla's more focused on things like battery technology and like the skateboard technology, et cetera. But they have struggled. And we've seen that in their more recent strategic decisions to kind of pare back some of their electric vehicle production to shift more toward hybrid vehicle, hybrid EV production. So it's not going to be a linear path for the established automakers, but we do think that they will be, you know, they will contribute to the growth in the electric vehicle market. It's just probably not going to be quite as impressive as those who have done it with a clean sheet of paper, if you will.
Jason, I truly appreciate you being able to pop from different, you know, category to different category, and I'm going to change it again on you. And that is, there have been 45 IPOs on the U.S. stock market in 2024, which is slightly less than 2023 by this date. What has come to the market that's interested you, and are there any upcoming IPOs we should watch?
Yeah, it's a great question. There haven't been too many that have come to market that have interested us here at Albion. We haven't bought any. We typically don't play in the IPO market early on. We want to see an established record after a company goes public. There are lockup periods that can create, you know, almost like a trap door, if you will, if you jump into the IPO too soon. So we typically are a little more patient on how we approach IPOs. But yeah, I mean, if you look at the list of companies, we've seen a number of biotechs that have come public this year, which I think is great for that space. And of course, that's good not only for the importance of the work that these biotech companies are doing, but that market was frozen for well over 2 years. So that's good to see. As I kind of look down the, obviously Reddit has received a fair amount of, you know, oxygen in the conversation. I don't really see like an impressive business model when I look at Reddit, but that's my personal opinion. There's certainly others that do. And then as we're kind of looking down the pipe here this year, I think, you know, a company like Klarna, which is the largest Swedish fintech company that's could go public some point here, could be an interesting one. I think fintech is a space with a lot of promise, a lot of opportunity. There's a lot of, it's fast moving. There's a lot of change that's happening, both at the consumer level as well as the bank level. So like you said, definitely a lot happening. And finally, we are seeing the IPO market unthaw because, of course, stock prices are higher. There's this notion that the Fed is, you know, done raising interest rates and might begin cutting here soon. Financial conditions have loosened. And of course, that's made the IPO path a little bit easier.
Before we go, I can't resist. You've mentioned a couple of terms like lockups and trapdoors. I can't resist asking about Truth Social. A couple of questions. One is, you know, if you look at the fundamental economics of Truth Social, the revenues and the income certainly don't come anywhere near being consistent with the current stock price. Is this looking like a meme stock? And I also saw something on CNBC that it was extremely expensive to short it. Why would that be?
Yeah, I was hoping we wouldn't go here, but we're going to go here, so let's do it. yeah, look.
Well, Jason, we could be out of time.
Well, if you can finagle that, please do. No, but look, this is a $5 billion market cap company that has pretty much no revenue. And they went public using, you know, kind of the SPAC approach, and it's a mess. And it's not one that I see fundamental value in personally. And like you said, it's definitely a stock that I think is a lightning rod for your views on politics.
Right.
You know, if you support Trump and you want him to be president and you're part of that group, then you might buy the stock because, you know, almost more of a show of support. It's that emotional part of our brain that's going to make that decision as opposed to the logical part of our brain. As I look at the fundamentals, to your point, you know, obviously there's no earnings, there's no free cash flow. Again, it's revenues scant, and yet it has a $5 billion market cap. So, you know, I'll let your listeners decide what they want to do with it, but it's not my cup of tea.
Well, we've been speaking with Jason Ware. He is the Chief Investment Officer for Albion Financial. Jason, thank you so much for spending time with us on Mountain Money.
Of course. Always a pleasure. Thank you, guys.
One of the most prevalent side effects of work from home is the emergence of bad behavior, according to Laura Driven, founder and chief executive officer of Paratus Consulting, a management firm that works with Fortune 1000 clients to untangle complex projects to accelerate strategy. Laura joins us this morning. Laura, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thanks so much, Allison and Roger. I'm glad to be here.
Let's begin. Working from home definitely became prevalent during the pandemic, yet it was not a new idea prior to that time. Can you give us an overview of how many of your clients had work from home policies prior to the pandemic?
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, go for it.
I'm sorry, no, actually, not too many, actually none of them did, to be honest. We deal mostly with Fortune 1000. And so in that respect, they didn't. Now, we as a company have dealt in a remote work as well as a Fortune 1000, based on simply the fact that they have global offices, they have multiple locations in the country. And so it was always that remote setting in the business prior to COVID.
And you make an interesting point, because as we now see sort of increasing pressures among many sort of larger corporations to push their employees to start coming to the office several days a week, one of the responses I've heard is, well, wait a minute, I'm dealing with a team in Chicago and San Francisco. Why does it matter if I'm in my office in Los Angeles?
Well, I have an extreme bias that you'll hear today, and that is, even though there was remote, it was remote offices, so people were still together. Mm-hmm. There is an isolation that has changed with COVID that is causing a different outcome for companies. By being in my LA home versus an LA office is different, in that you are isolated. And what I am seeing is that there are new and different behaviors that have come out in the type of projects that we manage, where it is from all over. We're seeing different behaviors than we've experienced in the past.
And so, again, you know, many companies are asking their employees to return to the offices. And so what you're saying is it's truly the team environment. I also assume that maybe some have, you know, leases for those office spaces and, you know, investments in kind of the space that may be also leading to those decisions.
Absolutely. I think there are the tactical reasons that companies are using, such as we have a building, we want you to use it. Not necessarily a fan of that being the reason alone. I think there are plenty of other reasons that they should be using and explaining why. Collaboration. When you see a team that works together face to face, there tends to be it's easier to collaborate. It's easier to innovate. I think the benefit of bringing teams together is we forget that there's a new generation since COVID that is coming into the workforce. How do you mentor and coach them appropriately? Even just talent retention and talent management becomes important. And maintaining an organization's culture. I'm not necessarily saying people have to come back in 5 days a week. I am a believer that hybrid can work quite well, but the fully remote is where I tend to see more problems occur.
We certainly want to get to talking about bad behavior, because how would anybody resist a fun topic like that? But I do want to stay with what you are seeing in terms of large publicly traded companies. You know, what is the trend toward requiring in-person presence? Are we seeing a push toward a three-day-a-week work week, 4 days, 5 days? What's the range of things you're seeing? And is there sort of a sweet spot that you're seeing people gravitate to in terms of demanding in-office presence?
Yeah, I think that right now, sort of still, I'll quote it, is sort of still coming out of COVID. More recently, I'm seeing 2 to 3 days as average, but I am seeing I'm hearing more and more about the executive team is looking for a little bit more, maybe 4 days a week. I don't know if they'll jump to five, but they are trying to push a little bit more. I'm seeing more of that as a trend where they're starting to look for a little bit more than what they've been getting to date. And I think five would be difficult, but I just heard an example just the other day of a company who was early in bringing people back during COVID and a Fortune 1000, and surprisingly, they only lost one person in that effort of bringing people back. I think there's a lot of talk of people don't want to, but I think if it's worded appropriately and shows the value, that often there's less avoidance of it than you might think. Probably full back might be more of the problem.
Are there quantitative studies out yet? I guess it's a little early as to, you know, what happens to employee retention and all those other things as we change these policies. That's probably something we won't see for a couple of years looking backward. But is there anything out yet?
Not that I'm aware of. I will tell you that I do believe that it is easier when you are fully remote to lose people because there is less cultural connection when you are in a remote environment, so that when you take away all of the things, when you look at any list of why people stay at a company, it is because they like the people they work with, they like the manager they work with, and they like the type of work they're doing, and money comes down lower. But when you start to remove that personal touch of, well, I'm not really with my team enjoying them, and I'm not really don't have that much time with my manager, you get down to money. So money becomes the top by default.
It's a loss of personal glue that I think you're talking about. And I know that when I was working in the business world, we would have, it was the 10 minutes after the meeting with the client or with the other party was over, when you would have an explanation of what really went on in that meeting, that was both the training element that was hugely important, and also a glue element that you sort of you were forming relationships with the people that you worked for, the people that worked for you.
Without a doubt, and I know it's sort of unrelated, and this is purely theoretical, but you hear about mental health issues with children who missed out on that connection, and other groups, I'm not a mental health expert, but I cannot I have to wonder, how can that not affect adults as well? We were in an environment where we were constantly with other people and socializing as well as working in most places and most work environments, and then that goes away. I can't help but wonder if that is also related to why we're seeing some of what we're seeing.
So let's talk about what you're seeing. You know, what types of bad behaviors have employees who work from home adopted?
I think there is a lack of accountability that we're seeing more of. You know, out of sight, out of mind makes it easier to act out in situations. You know, acting out on a Teams call or a Zoom call can be tuning out. It can be, you know, pushing off your work and delaying it. Or what we've seen a lot of is sometimes, well, I won't be accountable to my role, but I like your role better. I'm going to start to, you know, intercede and take over some of what you're supposed to be doing. So causing disruption on a project team, we're seeing more and more of. And understand that Peridius has always worked with large projects where there are always people. You're always going to have a difficult sponsor or a stakeholder or a team member. But it's different enough that we have been able to say, this is not behavior that we're used to. And some of it is outside of our control, in that we see that disruption is not only from the employee end, but it's on the management end. And before I go into the management end, I was worried at first when I started talking about this that this was more anecdotal, but there has been the LA Times, Business Times has written about this recently, that companies are seeing more and more bad behavior. So you see, I see it on the employee side, but I also am seeing it on the management side. It's not a lack of supervision, but a lack of management, where in the past, if someone acted out or didn't do what they were supposed to, the manager would talk to them. And if it continued, they'd put them on a PIP, a performance improvement plan. That doesn't seem to happen quite as much as in our clients as it used to. We see that there has been less expectation of what managers of their team are expected to do. And I think that is a big reason why this is continuing in organizations.
Laura, take it down a level for people who aren't sort of real deep into the business world. Give us a more specific example of the kinds of things that you would characterize as bad behavior in a remote working environment.
Sure. We've seen where we're brought in to turn around a troubled project. And typically in those environments, what we've seen is the people who were previously involved, if they brought some other type of value to the project team, they would continue in that role. But if they were the ones running the project and they were not succeeding, they would be moved out. Well, now they're not being moved out necessarily. And so, or they're being moved to an adjacent role. And in that adjacent role, they are taking it upon themselves saying, no, I know you say I can't do this role anymore, but I'm going to. And so we're seeing pushback, and the team is confused, you know, who's actually owning this, and little noise from the management to clarify. So it becomes every man for themselves type of environment. And that is not very productive in a project setting or in a business setting. And it's left to continue. So we see that there's a lot of, well, we hope them from the management, well, we're hoping it goes away, or pretending it's not there at all, or hiring outside resources like us to help manage the issue for them. And the problem with that is, you know, when we're hired to solve a problem, but we can't deal with personnel issues. We're not part of the company. And there's a lot of that, not just with Paredes, but we're seeing it with other consulting firms dealing with the same type of thing. They're brought in for a reason, and then it extends to, well, can you help us with some of this bad behavior? Or the assumption of not even mentioning it and just hoping that they will help with that bad behavior. And it's disruptive. And it not only to the with the individual themselves, but the project team that has to deal with it as well.
Is it that the bad behavior is not being addressed? I mean, I think it is that you're saying, like, it's not being addressed quick enough, but I'm trying to imagine kind of those cases where I was in an in-person office and then remote office. You know, with regards to being in an in-person office, when there's an issue with a team member, a lot of times you see the other staff, like, talking in the break room about them. And is it that the manager isn't seeing the other staff members upset? You know, is it that they're not seeing the small talk amongst the other team members? Because it feels like that may be the only missing element.
It is a big part of that, Allison. I think you, that's a big part of it, that they're not feeling the pain of the team, or they're ignoring it. Remember, difficult conversations, there's so many, you know, podcasts about how do you have a difficult conversation. Well, working remote makes it very easy to avoid mm-hmm. difficult conversations. You're not in the office. They could say, oh, I'll deal with this when we get to the office, but, you know, our schedules are so busy, I'm not quite sure when we're in, when I'm going to be able to talk to them. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to find a reason not to have that conversation. And I think it comes down to avoidance at times, pretending it isn't there. And one thing, you know, like I said, hiring outside resources, I will tell you, LA Times and Business Times talked about this situation, and what companies are starting to do is hire for etiquette training, which I personally think is ridiculous. I'm going on the line saying that. This is not a matter of people not knowing how to act. It is a matter, they all acted fine pre-COVID. It is a matter of holding them accountable and management making sure that they are being acting accountable to their role. Etiquette training is, I think it will be a waste of money and time for these companies that are doing that.
So before we go, can you just share a little bit about what you suggest to senior management about being proactive in terms of avoiding these bad behaviors? What kinds of measures do you tell them or do you recommend that they should put into place to minimize this kind of bad behavior?
I think it really comes down to bringing back the methods pre-COVID of training and retraining managers of how to manage employee performance and holding them accountable to it. So putting in the process where they can't avoid that their team is complaining and ignoring it, that if the managers are not doing that, then executive team needs to be taking a look at that, because this is without it, it's a great way to lose good people. So retrain managers on how to manage these performance issues, poor performance, poor behavior. What isn't needed is etiquette training. It is really, let's get back to the role that we hired you to do, and that was to manage people. Let's make sure you're doing that.
There is so much, I assume, to unravel as we continue to look at this topic for future. We've been speaking with Laura Dribben. She is with Paredes Consulting. Laura, thank you so much for joining us on Mountain Money.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was great today. I appreciate the time.
Exclusive Resorts is a unique vacation company that was founded in 2002 by former AOL executive Steve Case. Here to talk about the company's unique model and how it has evolved is CEO James Henderson. Morning, James. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Roger. How are you?
Excellent. So let's start with a bit of history. Tell us a little bit about the original model for Exclusive Resorts and what the original vision was.
Sure. Yeah. Well, firstly, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. The club was founded in 2002 and has really been around to support a number of members. And our goal really is to transform how the world traveled well. We've been operating for 20 years. The business has 400 homes and experiences in 75 destinations. We deliver something in the region of 18,000 vacations a year. And we have a portfolio of about $1 billion worth of private homes that we operate. So that makes us one of the largest owners and operators of luxury residences worldwide. Homes typically sort of 3 to 4 bedroom homes that we have. They're all private for members only. And then we also run experiences as well, which are sort of group and private travel itineraries for members. And I think the thing that differentiates us is really three things, really. Relationship-based service is one of the key things. We have dedicated ambassadors who plan people's vacations out for them, and concierges. We also operate on a significant level of, I think, quality and consistency, because when you're traveling within the club, you're always traveling within one of the exclusive resorts' homes and with our teams. And then we also have a community of about 4,500 like-minded members, and that's a significant part of the club, where people join and they get to meet other members who have very similar sort of likes and interests around travel.
So you had mentioned like-minded members. Who are the target customers, and how do you talk to them about the value proposition of exclusive resorts?
So really, it's anyone that is someone's interested in travel, people who like to travel. And we talk about the value proposition really around those sort of things that I mentioned. I mean, the reason people join is they're looking for a seamless travel experience. They're looking for something that is going to enable them to travel within a closed group of homes within our system, and everything's taken care of. So you have a vacation ambassador that gets to know the members really well. We get to know what they like. We really understand their preferences. We understand how they travel. Do they book short term? Do they book long term? And a lot of our members have been with us for some of them up to 20 years. So we get to know, you know, their individual preferences in terms of food, drink, activities, and things like that. And then when they go to interdestination, we also have concierges on the ground that will plan everything on the ground. So we take care of everything from all the bookings on the ground, from restaurants, from activities, and we can think about really how members like to travel. And so we can predict a little bit what they want to do, and we can do surprise and delights for them within the system. So that's one of the things. I think the other thing that is a big differentiator for us in terms of a value proposition is really that, you know, when you're traveling with exclusive resorts, you're always traveling within either one of our homes or with our teams that are on the ground. So, you know, we test every experience that we do. When you're in the homes that we have, you're always with exclusive resorts people in those destinations. And then the other part of our value proposition is that we're a fixed price model. So we tend to have a pretty compelling rate, which is fixed at the beginning of the year, and you pay the same amount as you travel.
And one element of that is that, as I understand it, the homes are tend to have kitchens, and you can have groceries, and a lot. And you know, with the multiple bedrooms, you're sort of holding up that model. Many of the homes, as I understand it, are connected to resorts or in as resort adjacent properties, such that you can experience some of the resort experiences while at the same time being able to make your own breakfast if that's what you want to do, and offering that as an alternative to multiple hotel rooms when a family travels.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think a lot of people, they like the benefits of being in a resort and having all the amenities of a resort, but they like to be in their own home as well. And I think that's something that we've also seen through the pandemic. You know, people want private spaces, they want to be in a home, and they want to be in their own environment. And then they also want to be able to go out into resorts. So of the 350 homes or so that we have within the system, 200 of those are actually in resort environments. So we're in Rosewoods, we're in Four Seasons, we're in Ritz-Carlton's and things like that. So, you know, when you're there, you can have your family, you have a full kitchen, and you have your lounge area, and you have 3 or 4 bedrooms typically. And some of the homes that we have pools, and so you can retreat to your own private space. And then when you want to go out to the resort, you can also experience all of the amenities in the resort. So people tend to like that, and I think we saw a lot of that during the pandemic, that people really wanted to have their own private spaces. And it was a sort of a safe sanctuary, if you like. And that's certainly something that has driven a lot of interest and demand for us.
So the homes that you talk about, they're definitely high quality. Are these homes owned by exclusive resorts, or do you work with property management companies? How does that work?
No, we do a bit of both, really. So we the portfolio that we have, we own about 65% of the homes that we operate. So we have about $1 billion worth of portfolio, and we own about $720 million worth of homes ourselves. And so we operate those. And it really depends on the location. Some of them are standalone homes. We typically don't have homes that are less than four homes in one destination, because we have on-site teams and concierges that are in the location that will look after members. So, but we also have homes in resorts as well. So, for example, if you go to somewhere like the Montage, you could be in units within the Montage that we own and operate. So, as Kapalua, for example, we have, I think, 11 or 12 homes at the Montage in Kapalua, and you're staying within the resort, in the resort environment, and you're looked after by the teams on the ground.
Looks like we've just got a blip in the connection, and it's coming back.
That's the eclipse.
maybe it's not coming back. I'm going to just...
Let's go. We spend...
James, we lost you for a minute. Take a step back.
Oh, you did?
We lost you about 30 seconds.
Sorry, where did you lose me?
I think we were talking about, Allison, we were talking about the homes that you own. About 65% of the homes are owned, and I think that's about where we lost you.
Okay, yeah, so we have about, so the portfolio we operate, we have about $1 billion portfolio. We own about 65% of those homes. And we typically try to have about a minimum of four homes in one destination, because that way we can have a dedicated team on the ground. And we can have people that will look after members in those locations. It's very hard to do that when you have less than four homes. In some cases we have, you know, in Costa Rica, we run a resort with about 21 homes in that location.
I want to ask, 20 years, as I understand it, 15 or 20 years ago, there were a number of somewhat similar offerings, many of which have not survived. Why do you think Exclusive has managed to make it through the last 20 years? Why are you still here?
That's a great question. I think a significant part of that is we're very conservative as an organization, as you outlined at the beginning of the call, where, you know, we're privately owned. We own the majority of our portfolio. I think that gives us significant stability in the business. You know, our balance sheet today is probably $300 million stronger than it was 4 years ago. The pricing model that we have is simple. I think we offer a pretty high level of value when you compare us to traditional booking in luxury hotels and villa rentals and things like that. And we also include all of the sort of dedicated planning and concierge and community support. And I think the other thing is that we have a really good, strong, loyal base of members. We have 4,500 member families. We have a 98.5% retention ratio of that. And I think we've just been pretty consistent in delivering. And, you know, we grow probably 5 to 8% a year. So we've been pretty conservative in terms of our growth targets.
A 98% renewal is amazing. When you talk about the experiences, can you tell us a little bit more about them and how have they become a significant part of the portfolio?
Yeah, so the experiences are tremendous. I mean, we do, we run a series of member-only trips. These are full-service vacations. They're true bucket list type trips. They're everything from African safaris, Southeast Asia tours, Australia, New Zealand. For the last few years, we've done around the world.
And it's given us a headache again. Let's see if it comes on back.
And like 500 departures on about 120 different itineraries. So this is something that is unique for us. These are really once-in-a-lifetime bucket list type trips that people can do. And this, they're a great connector, and it's a great chance for members to meet other members on those trips.
Now, I know you personally, I understand you personally have gone on one or more of these. Can you sort of describe one of those in a little more detail so people get a real sense of what it's like?
Yeah, so I went on, my last one I went on was to Antarctica. It was a ship that we chartered through Lindblad. We had about 130 members on the ship. It was about a 9-day cruise. And the nice thing about that is, firstly, the itinerary is amazing. You go to this amazing destination. But you're with other people that you feel this immediate sort of sense of bonding when you're on the ship with other members, and you can connect with them and you get to know them. It's almost like a reunion in some cases, because members have seen other members before. So firstly, you're sort of within this great environment, and then you're sharing these incredible experiences. And I think this is one of the things that I think is so unique to Exclusive. You have this chance to bond and connect with other members. It's a true community, which I think is the differentiator. So as well as traveling these fabulous destinations and locations, you get to be part of this community and meet other like-minded people.
As we conclude the interview, can you let our listeners know how they can find out more about exclusive resorts?
Absolutely, yeah. You can go to our website, exclusiveresorts.com, and you'll find all about us at on our website. It'll give you a pretty good indication of what we do, how we do it, and all the trips that we do in our portfolio.
Okay, we've been speaking with James Henderson. He is the CEO of Exclusive Resorts. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.